Welcome to A Catcher Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of the Catcher AI. So, today we're taking a deep dive into George Eliot's really quite monumental 1860 novel, The Mill on the Floss. It's one of those books that feels like both a profound philosophical question and a deeply personal story. And of course, we have to mention the author, Marianne Evans, using that male pseudonym, George Eliot. It wasn't just about anonymity, was it? It was a strategic move, really, to make sure her incredibly intelligent work on morality, psychology, well, that it got taken seriously, especially in that Victorian context, which wasn't always kind to women writers dealing with big ideas.
Absolutely. And you feel that personal weight straight away. It's arguably her most autobiographical novel. Mm-hmm. It sort of blends that Bildungsroman style, you know, the coming of age story, moral growth with something much darker, almost like a Greek tragedy. And the setting itself, St. Ogg's, the River Floss, it's not just scenery. It feels alive, soaked in memory, particularly for Maggie Tulliver.
Right. So our task today, I think, is to really get under the surface beyond just the plot beats. We want to explore that central, really agonizing conflict Eliot presents, this struggle to square passionate individual desire with these incredibly rigid social rules and family duties. It's a conflict that almost feels designed for heartbreak, doesn't it? Okay, let's unpack this.
Mm-hmm. And to get at that, you have to start with the Tullivers and Dorlcote Mill. The mill is everything to them. It's their identity, their history, this place of, well, nostalgic beauty, but also pride. But the seeds of trouble are planted right there.
Yeah.
You know? Rooted in Mr. Tulliver's very hot temper, his pride, and that disastrous lawsuit against the lawyer, Mr. Wakeham, that financial ruin. It's not just about money. It strips them of who they are and creates this kind of toxic inheritance for Tom and Maggie.
And the real core of the conflict, the sort of emotional current driving the whole novel, it flows right through Maggie Tulliver. Eliot draws her with such complexity. She's fiercely smart, has this incredible imagination, and just this desperate, aching need for love, for acceptance.
Yeah.
But her intelligence, her passion, they become her curse almost. Because the narrow world she lives in, St. Ogg's, it just sees her complexity as, well, dangerous, unfeminine, unpredictable.
And the absolute center of her world, both the good and the bad, is her bond with her brother, Tom. It's this really primal, intense sibling thing, but they're just fundamentally different people. Maggie's all intuition, feeling, impulse.
Yeah.
She's the dark-eyed one, seen as too clever, too wild.
Well, Tom is the perfect product of that conventional Victorian world. Practical, dutiful, maybe a bit dogmatic. He has this really rigid, unbending sense of honor. Now, he loves Maggie, you feel that, but it's a possessive love, and crucially, it's conditional.
Mm-hmm. Conditional on her fitting his mold.
Exactly. He just doesn't have the imagination, the empathy to grasp, as Eliot puts it, the very essence of her being.
Yeah, it's that classic tragedy of people bound together but speaking completely different languages, emotionally and morally.
So when you trace Maggie's path through the novel, what you see is this constant, really painful back and forth. One minute she's asserting herself, her needs. The next she's practicing this extreme self-denial, sacrificing everything just to get that approval, especially from Tom.
And the narrator steps right in sometimes, doesn't she? To defend Maggie, there's that incredible line.
Yeah.
She was punished for the sin of being born with a nature that demanded more love than the world was prepared to give her.
It hits hard. That's not just observation. It's an indictment of the world around her.
Mm-hmm. And Tom's journey is almost the mirror image in a way, but just as tragic in its own right. After the family loses everything, he takes on that whole patriarchal weight. His life becomes about restoring the family name, the money. And he swears that really bitter vow of vengeance against Wakeham right there at his father's bedside.
You have to admire his determination in a way.
You do. It's almost heroic. But his inner world just freezes. Duty becomes purely about money, about paying people back. There's no room for forgiveness, no flexibility. And his demand for Maggie's absolute obedience is part of that rigid structure. It's proof of her loyalty in his eyes.
Which, of course, makes her later choices utterly impossible, because she meets two men who pull her in completely opposite directions. First, there's Philip Wakeham.
Wakeham's son, the enemy's son.
Exactly. And he's physically frail, but he offers Maggie something Tom never could. Intellectual companionship, a spiritual connection, a true meeting of minds, grounded in understanding.
And then there's Stephen Guest, handsome, rich, charming.
Yeah, and he represents something totally different. That raw, powerful, almost overwhelming force of romantic passion, of physical desire.
He's the chaos Maggie spent her whole life trying to suppress through duty and renunciation. And she finds she just can't reason it away. He really forces the crisis point.
Okay, so let's walk through how this plays out. The early parts establish the mill, that childhood bond, Maggie's attempts to gain Tom's approval. Remember her cutting her hair?
Oh, yes. And Tom's focus on his rabbits, very practical even then. And those early, tentative, secret meetings between Maggie and Philip start then, too.
But then comes the downfall. Books 3 to 5, really. Mr. Tulliver loses the mill to Wakeham, has the stroke.
And forces Tom to swear on the Bible to pay them all back. That moment just cements this whole legacy of bitterness. It hangs over everything.
And then Tom finds out about Maggie and Philip.
And he sees it purely as betrayal. Betrayal of the father, of the vow of him. His reaction is furious. He confronts Philip, forces Maggie's hand. Choose me, choose the family duty, or choose him, be cut off.
And she chooses duty. Again, renouncing Philip, renouncing that part of herself. It really shows how trapped she is by the past.
Which brings us to book 6, The Great Temptation.
Right, and this is where things really accelerate. Maggie's visiting her cousin, Lucy Dean.
Who happens to be engaged to Stephen Guest.
Exactly, and mm-hmm. Elliot just masterfully shows this uncontrollable spark between Maggie and Stephen. It's mutual, it's powerful, almost like a force of nature itself, and Maggie tries so hard to fight it.
And comes the boat trip, that iconic scene on the River Floss. Stephen, completely carried away by his passion, rows them much further downriver than planned.
He basically intends to elope.
Yeah, and Maggie is, quite literally, carried along by the current, by the momentum of events.
Yeah.
But when they stop, when she has a moment to choose, she makes a hard choice. She refuses him. She refuses to build her happiness on betraying Lucy, betraying Philip. She chooses to go back and face the consequences.
But the terrible irony, the real sting, is that her moral choice counts for nothing in the eyes of St. Ogg's.
Nothing at all.
She returns and she's immediately labeled a fallen woman. She becomes complete outcast. The whole town turns against her.
Including Tom. In his absolute adherence to social convention, he throws her out. He can't see past the appearance of impropriety.
And that's Elliot's critique right there, isn't it? Society condemns her not for the elopement she refused to go through with, but just for having the capacity for that passion, appearance over actual moral substance.
Which leads almost inevitably to the final devastating tragedy, the River Floss itself, the symbol of time, memory, Maggie's own passionate currents, breaks its banks. A huge catastrophic flood.
And Maggie, in this final act of love and perhaps redemption, rows out into that raging water. She's trying to rescue Tom, who's trapped back at the mill.
And it's only there, facing death, that the years of misunderstanding and judgment finally fall away.
Tom sees her. Really sees her. He calls her Magsy, her childhood name. It's that moment of unconditional acceptance, of reconciliation.
But it's too late. Just as they find each other, their boat is smashed by debris from the ruined mill, and they drown together. In each other's arms, as the novel famously ends.
Wow, that ending. It makes you think about the symbolism, doesn't it? The flood isn't just random. It feels like the inevitable breaking point for all those pent-up emotions and social pressures.
And the mill, the source of their identity, their pride, their ruin, becomes the site of their final reunion and death.
For me, one of the deepest themes that emerges from all this is what you called the tragedy of misunderstanding, or maybe the inarticulacy of love.
Mm-hmm.
Maggie and Tom clearly love each other deeply, profoundly, yet they spend their whole lives causing each other immense pain. Why? Because they operate on completely different moral and emotional wavelengths.
Yeah, Elliot seems to be saying that the worst suffering often comes not from outright malice, but from this simple failure of imagination. The inability or maybe unwillingness to truly understand another person's inner world.
And maybe that's what the narrative voice, that famous omniscient narrator, is trying to combat.
I think so. Elliot doesn't just tell a story. The narrator is this constant presence-wise, compassionate, analytical, always probing motives, highlighting blind spots, offering commentary. It's that psychological depth, that refusal to offer easy judgments, that makes the novel feel so modern, so pioneering. It asks us to observe, yes, but also to understand with compassion.
So I guess the question it leaves us with, even today, is how do we navigate this? The Mill on the Floss really forces us to look beyond those rigid rules, social rules, family rules. It makes us confront the complexity of the human heart, those hidden currents of desire and duty. Is it even possible to live a life fully committed to duty without somehow extinguishing your own essential self?
And maybe the tragic point is that for Maggie and Tom, real forgiveness, that unconditional understanding, only arrived when the very structure of their judgmental society was literally washed away. It took a cataclysm.
A sobering thought. And it brings us back to that final unforgettable line.
In their death, they were not divided.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.